Welcome to this Peer Voice activity. To access the entire activity, including supporting material, go to www.peervoice.com/QKR. This activity is supported by an independent medical educational grant from the BI and Lilly Alliance and Bayer AG. Welcome to this Peer Voice activity on chronic kidney disease in type 2 diabetes. This activity comprises a series of 7 streaming episodes with Professor Pinar Topseva and Dr. Jennifer Green. At any time during this presentation, you may download supporting materials and share this activity with colleagues.
Hello, I'm Pinar Topseva. I'm a professor of family medicine working at Acıbadem University School of Medicine. Welcome to this activity comprising 7 short episodes where we will address how to screen, manage, and treat chronic kidney disease in people with type 2 diabetes. In this first episode, I will discuss with you the crucial role of screening for chronic kidney disease in type 2 diabetes to detect it early. Chronic kidney disease is a public health problem, largely caused by diabetes. It is characterized by intermittent or persistent albuminuria and/or progressive decline in glomerular filtration rate. If chronic kidney disease is not detected early and managed properly, it will ultimately progress to end-stage renal disease. According to the data of the Global Burden of Disease study, which has been published in 2019, diabetes and chronic kidney disease were the 7th largest non-communicable diseases, the 4th leading cause of death, and the 6th leading cause of disability worldwide. So huge disease burden. The worldwide incidence, prevalence, and mortality of type 2-related chronic kidney disease has increased during the past 30 years in men and women and in all age groups. Furthermore, the prevalence and mortality have increased with age. When we look at the association of chronic kidney disease with type 2 diabetes, we see that approximately 40 to 50% of patients with type 2 diabetes may eventually develop chronic kidney disease. Chronic kidney disease is associated with most of the excess all-cause and cardiovascular mortality observed in patients with diabetes. Patients with diabetes and chronic kidney disease are at risk for progression to kidney failure and for need for kidney replacement therapy. Elderly patients with type 2 diabetes are more likely to develop chronic kidney disease than those without, and this is true especially for those with a diabetes duration of more than 10 years. The severe burden of CKD in patients with type 2 diabetes can further be observed in patients with early kidney disease and diabetes. For these patients, it has been shown that the life expectancy is shorter by approximately 15 years in men and 17 years in women as compared with that of a reference group without CKD or type 2 diabetes. Moreover, patients with early kidney disease and type 2 diabetes have a shorter life average compared to those with diabetes or CKD alone. CKD progression can be asymptomatic until the disease reaches advanced stages. This calls for the need of early screening, because diagnosis is challenging due to this asymptomatic course. And regular screening actually helps detect the condition early when interventions are still effective. Early diagnosis of CKD may prove vital in patients with type 2 diabetes, allowing for more immediate clinical care and identification of the risk for progression to end-stage kidney disease. This may be particularly important in Afro-Caribbean, African-American, Hispanic, and Asian populations who tend to have a higher risk of chronic kidney disease progression relative to Caucasians. The increased risk in these populations may be explained in part by factors such as higher blood pressure and increased prevalence of type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. As a summary, I would like to highlight that chronic kidney disease related to type 2 diabetes can progress silently for years, which causes a huge disease burden on the patient's quality of life. It is crucial that we appreciate the positive impact that appropriate and regular screening and follow-up can have on patients who can be managed timely to prevent complications and improve outcomes. This is even more relevant now that novel therapies are available that could effectively prevent progression of chronic kidney disease. And this is something that we can achieve in the primary healthcare setting. Thank you for watching. Join me at the next episode where I will discuss how to screen for chronic kidney disease in patients with type 2 diabetes. Hello, I'm Dr. Pinar Topsever. In this episode, I will discuss with you how you can incorporate screening for chronic kidney disease in people with type 2 diabetes in your daily clinical practice. First of all, let's look at the definition of chronic kidney disease. The diagnostic criteria for chronic kidney disease include, first, an estimated glomerular filtration rate, or eGFR, less than 60 milliliters per minute, which should be persistent for at least 3 months. Persistent albuminuria, defined by urine albumin creatinine ratio equal to or higher than 30 milligrams per gram, is also an indicator of chronic kidney disease, which may be observed on its own or in conjunction with abnormal eGFR levels. Other markers of kidney damage, such as hematuria or structure abnormalities, may also indicate chronic kidney disease. Let's see how to screen for chronic kidney disease. Screening for CKD can be easily performed in primary care by measuring serum creatinine and estimating the glomerular filtration rate using a serum creatinine-based equation that takes into account the patient's age and sex. Remember that normal GFR varies according to age, sex, body size, and is also physiologically declining with age. In addition to the eGFR, you should also request a urine test to assess the urine albumin to creatinine ratio, or UACR. The easiest method to measure albuminuria is in a single random spot urine sample. It is advised to have a morning urine sample, although samples from any time of the day will do, in order not to miss a preventive opportunity. If you don't have access to UACR testing, use a urine dipstick to check for protein in the urine. When should we screen? The ADA and KDIGO guidelines recommend to start screening for chronic kidney disease in patients with type 2 diabetes at diabetes diagnosis. This is because, as we had discussed earlier, CKD may be present without any evident symptoms. CKD screening for patients with type 2 diabetes should be repeated annually. Finally, what we should do in case the results are in line with the CKD diagnosis is to remember to reassess the eGFR within 3 months. Only if values persist to be less than 60 milliliters per minute, then that would indicate CKD. When you recalculate the eGFR, you can consider to request a measurement of serum cystatin C, because that would increase the precision in patients without albuminuria. It increases the precision of the eGFR estimation. The values of albuminuria are also variable, and as the eGFR, should be rechecked within 3 to 6 months to confirm the diagnosis of CKD. So if any of these two tests, eGFR or UACR, are abnormal twice within 3 months, that would indicate a diagnosis of chronic kidney disease. If your patient shows persistently an eGFR less than 60 and a UACR more than 30 milligrams per gram, this would indicate a diagnosis of chronic kidney disease. From this point on, you should discuss with your patient this diagnosis and all possible evidence-based treatment options that are in place to delay possible CKD progression. Thank you for watching. Join me at the next episode where we will discuss risk stratification for chronic kidney disease and next steps in patient management. Hello, I'm Dr. Pinar Topsever. In this episode, I will discuss with you risk stratification for chronic kidney disease and next steps in patient management. As a quick reminder, a chronic kidney disease diagnosis is based on the levels of eGFR and a UACR. Once we obtain and confirm the values, we can stratify patients into 5 different categories based on eGFR, from G1, which indicates normal levels, to G5, which indicates kidney failure. Stratification can also be done with albuminuria levels. Based on these levels, patients are divided into 3 different risk categories, with A1 corresponding to normal levels and A3 corresponding to severely increased levels of albuminuria. These 2 measurements are combined together and allow patient risk stratification. We can map patient's value on the KDIGO matrix, which tells us the risk of CKD progression, the number of times per year we need to call our patient to the clinic for monitoring and screening, and whether the patient should be referred to secondary care, meaning to see a nephrologist or an endocrinologist or a diabetologist. Although this is a very helpful tool, we need, of course, to remember that each patient is unique and individual, and that according to other additional risk factors and comorbidities, our patients may need additional care or other referral. For this reason, integration of care, which ensures communication and collaboration among different specialties like primary care and secondary care, can help achieve the best management for our patients with CKD and type 2 diabetes. In addition to all this, although it's challenging in terms of time management, it's very important to educate and counsel our patients about the risks of chronic kidney disease, which will empower them to engage more in patient self-care. So, what to do after we have our values? If we have 2 values of eGFR and UACR within 3 months, which are all normal, then we should continue to screen our patient with type 2 diabetes on an annual basis. So even though everything is okay, call your patient with type 2 diabetes back within a year to retest for chronic kidney disease. If our results indicate that the patient has CKD and should be treated, we should immediately initiate appropriate management based on evidence-based guideline recommendations, but that will be discussed in the next episodes. Remember, when you start discussing therapy with your patient, to engage them in the conversations around any kind of treatment options and to implement shared decision-making when deciding for their management plan. Finally, if any of our values, eGFR or UACR, show in the KDIGO heat map that the patient should be referred, refer your patient immediately to secondary care. To summarize, early detection of chronic kidney disease in patients with type 2 diabetes is crucial to preserve kidney function and reduce risk of end-stage kidney disease, cardiovascular events, and mortality. Perform an annual check of UACR and eGFR in all patients with type 2 diabetes, irrespective of treatment and symptoms. Monitor UACR and eGFR more frequently in patients with type 2 diabetes and existing CKD with higher risk for progression, and that you can actually map in the KDIGO heat map. We have actually approved evidence-based treatments that can put a brake on CKD progression and offer renal protection and cardioprotection. And we have ample evidence that early therapeutic intervention in these patients prevents premature deaths. I encourage you all to screen, treat, or refer as early as possible all your patients with CKD and type 2 diabetes. With this final message, I would like to thank you for your attention and invite you to join the following episodes where Dr. Green will discuss the new therapeutic options that have recently been integrated into the guidelines for the care and management of chronic kidney disease in patients with type 2 diabetes.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Green. I'm a professor of medicine and diabetes and metabolism specialist at Duke Clinical Research Institute and the Duke University School of Medicine in Durham, North Carolina, in the U.S. In the previous episodes, my colleague Dr. Topsever explained why it is important to screen for chronic kidney disease in patients with type 2 diabetes and discuss the appropriate tools to do that screening. In the next four episodes, I'll discuss management options for CKD in patients with type 2 diabetes. But first, let's have a look at the evolving therapeutic landscape of CKD in type 2 diabetes, which has led to the latest changes in the KDIGO guidelines. This is a very nice way of remembering the three pillars of care for CKD management in people with type 2 diabetes. And these are pillars that are intended to slow progression of kidney disease, assuming that the patient's blood pressure and lipids are also adequately treated and controlled. A reminder that for people with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease, they have a clear indication for treatment with a RAS inhibitor, so an ACE or ARB at the maximum tolerated dose, as well as an SGLT2 inhibitor. On the far right, you'll see a column that refers to use of non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist therapy, which is considered second-line therapy and indicated for select individuals with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. Now, the care of people with chronic kidney disease has been revolutionized, essentially, following the completion of three large outcomes trials in patients with chronic kidney disease. And these three trials are CREDENCE, DAPA-CKD, and EMPA-KIDNEY. And these large outcomes trials studied the effects of the SGLT2 inhibitors canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, and empagliflozin versus placebo, respectively, in very large populations of individuals with chronic kidney disease. It's also important to remember that, again, moving from left to right on the screen, these trials enrolled ever broader populations of people with type 2 diabetes. So in CREDENCE, people with type 2 diabetes with significant albuminuria, DAPA-CKD enrolled the same population but allowed in people without diabetes, and EMPA-KIDNEY on the far right enrolled people with and without type 2 diabetes and with and without albuminuria. The primary composite outcome of each of these trials was fortunately quite similar, which allows us to make some types of comparisons between the outcomes, but all of the trials had as their primary composite outcome end-stage kidney disease, a very significant worsening of either serum creatinine or eGFR, and renal or cardiovascular death. You can see that these trials went on for a median of about 2.5 to 2 years overall, and they all were positive. So all of these SGLT2 inhibitors have been found to significantly reduce the risk of these important clinical outcomes in patients with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. It is, of course, important that we understand the risk of adverse events that occur with these types of therapies Reassuringly, in these three trials, the rates of adverse events and serious adverse events were generally similar overall between the SGLT2 inhibitor-treated and placebo-treated groups. A reminder, too, that many of our patients will have an indication for treatment with a non-steroidal MRA. The one that is available now is finerenone, and this slide shows the results of the fidelity pooled analysis of the large cardiovascular and kidney outcomes trials, which compared the effects of finerenone to placebo in people with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. And you can see that finerenone compared to placebo significantly reduced the risks of important composite cardiovascular and kidney outcomes. Again, with the finerenone trials, overall safety outcomes were generally similar between the treatment arms. So a reminder, we have these new pillars of care for the management of chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. RAS inhibition is recommended for everyone with these conditions and should definitely be initiated in patients who are hypertensive. Similarly, SGLT2 inhibitors are recommended as first-line therapy for people with type 2 diabetes and any evidence of chronic kidney disease. The non-steroidal MRA can be considered a second-line therapy for people who were already on those medications but who remain at risk for progression of their kidney disease or cardiovascular events. So thank you for watching. Join us at the next episode where I'll discuss how to incorporate these new agents in clinical practice. Hello, I'm Jennifer Green. In this episode, I'll discuss how to incorporate the more recently approved agents in the treatment regimens for people with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease. This is a very important algorithm published by the KDIGO group that refers specifically to the management of people with diabetes and chronic kidney disease. And I would like to focus primarily on the green and blue boxes that are highlighted. So, as we discussed in the previous episode, for people with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease, there is now a recommendation that if, again, they are hypertensive, they be treated with a RAS inhibitor at the maximum tolerated dose, but also, as you can see on the left, an SGLT2 inhibitor, which should be initiated if patients have an eGFR of at least 20, and they should stay on that medication until they require renal replacement therapy. In the highlighted box in the middle, we see a recommendation for use of a non-steroidal MRA. This is reserved for people who, if on those other therapies already, have a urine albumin to creatinine ratio, which remains elevated at 30 milligrams per gram or higher, and who have a normal potassium level. Other very important features of this algorithm include, to the far right, the recommendation that people with these conditions also be treated with a moderate or high intensity statin. So SGLT2 inhibitors have been shown to have both safety and kidney and cardiovascular outcomes benefit in patients with chronic kidney disease, and this includes people without type 2 diabetes. If patients with diabetes are already being treated with other glucose-lowering medications, the SGLT2 inhibitor can be added to the current treatment regimen, or in certain circumstances, you could potentially substitute it for other medicines that they're already taking. SGLT2 inhibitors which are approved for this particular use include canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, and empagliflozin, and it's very important to note that the cardiovascular and kidney outcomes benefits shown with the use of these medications occurs at the lowest therapeutic dose, so there is no need to uptitrate the dose to derive that outcomes benefit. When someone starts an SGLT2 inhibitor, we should anticipate an acute drop in their eGFR, which is not considered a reason to stop the SGLT2 inhibitor. A reminder that once the SGLT2 inhibitor is started, it is recommended that the patient with chronic kidney disease stay on the SGLT2 inhibitor, even if the eGFR falls below 20, unless, of course, it's not tolerated or the patient requires kidney replacement therapy, such as dialysis or kidney transplantation. Now shifting to finerenone, this agent is considered most appropriate for patients with type 2 diabetes who are at high risk of CKD progression and cardiovascular events, as demonstrated by persistent albuminuria, really of any degree, despite use of the other standard of care therapy. So of course, finerenone can be added and should often be added to pre-existing treatment with a RAS inhibitor and an SGLT2 inhibitor in patients with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. Thank you for watching. Join us at the next episode where I will discuss how to monitor patients with diabetes and chronic kidney disease when on therapy with an SGLT2 inhibitor or a non-steroidal MRA and adverse events of these treatments. Hello, I'm Jennifer Green. In this episode, I'll discuss the management of potential adverse events which might occur with use of SGLT2 inhibitors and non-steroidal MRA therapy in patients with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. The most common side effect associated with use of SGLT2 inhibitors is an increased risk of genital mycotic infections. Unfortunately, these don't tend to occur repeatedly, and they respond to traditional treatments for mycotic infections. But a bit of preventive strategy is also very reasonable, and I always counsel my patients on the importance of genital hygiene to keep that area clean and dry, and often pat dry after urination. A reminder that the SGLT2 inhibitors do have a glucose-lowering effect in people with type 2 diabetes, so there is a potential risk of hypoglycemia when these medicines are added to background therapy that includes a sulfonylurea and or insulin. And therefore, if you are starting an SGLT2 inhibitor in a patient whose glycemic control is already essentially at goal, it would be very appropriate to reduce those other therapies to, again, decrease the risk of hypoglycemia. A reminder, however, that the SGLT2 inhibitors tend to have less of a glucose-lowering effect once the eGFR drops below about 40 or 45. These medicines do have a potential osmotic diuretic effect, and so it is important that we consider the potential for SGLT2 inhibitors to cause some volume depletion. So if your patient is already a bit dry or hypovolemic or has a little bit of a low blood pressure, you may want to proactively reduce the dose of any other diuretics that they're on, or if they're not on diuretics, maybe decrease the doses of their other antihypertensives a bit until you can assess the impact of the SGLT2 inhibitor on their volume status. More rarely, these drugs have been associated with an increased risk of ketoacidosis. So in patients taking an SGLT2 inhibitor, it's very important that they're educated about potential signs or symptoms of DKA in order that it be recognized early and they receive prompt attention. So these, for example, would be abdominal pain, nausea or vomiting, and lethargy. In certain situations, it may be very appropriate for the patient to have a sick day protocol, which would include stopping the SGLT2 inhibitor, perhaps using insulin in its place, if appropriate, to make sure that they continue to eat carbohydrates and that, of course, they hydrate. And in patients who are using an SGLT2 inhibitor along with insulin, it is recommended that those individuals continue to take at least a low dose of insulin. With respect to finerenone therapy, the major potential side effect of this drug would be an increase in the potassium levels. So there are very specific guidelines that are recommended to ensure the safe use of this agent. So if a patient has a potassium level that's 4.8 or lower, it is perfectly acceptable to initiate finerenone at 10 milligrams a day if the eGFR is between 25 and 59, or 20 milligrams a day if the eGFR is 60 or above. And it's important to monitor the potassium level 1 month after the drug is started, and then every 4 months thereafter. If the potassium remains in that same range, 4.8 or lower, the dose could be increased to 20 milligrams a day. However, the potassium level is a bit higher, between 4.9 and 5.5, it would not be recommended that you increase the dose, but they can stay on their current dose of finerenone. And again, you would continue to monitor their potassium level every 4 months. Now, in certain circumstances, in patients on finerenone, their potassium level may be significantly higher. So if the potassium level is higher than 5.5, it is recommended that the finerenone medication be held and that you consider some counseling to the patient to see whether or not there might be adjustments in either their diet or even other medications which might mitigate their risk of future hyperkalemia. Of course, you'd need to follow the potassium to make sure the hyperkalemia resolves, and then you could consider restarting when the potassium is at 5 or below. So thank you for watching. Join us at the next episode where I will discuss the importance of collaborative care for patients with CKD and type 2 diabetes. Hello, I'm Jennifer Green. In this episode, we'll discuss how we can achieve a collaborative care model when managing patients with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. There are many potential barriers to the delivery of guideline-based care in patients with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes, and many of these are patient-specific, but many others are provider-specific and systems-based. So we need to be thoughtful and cognizant of the many potential barriers to the delivery of appropriate care in these individuals. And for example, on the patient level, there may be issues related to financial barriers, limited access to medicine or healthcare, particularly specialist services. But on the provider side, of course, even time constraints can be a barrier to the delivery of guideline-based care. So we need to be very thoughtful and think about locally appropriate ways to address these barriers, which may certainly vary depending upon your location or practice setting. Now, the good news is that there are many ways to address these barriers successfully using multi-component, integrated, and team-based care. And this would include a large number of strategies, including not just physician care and collaboration between primary care and specialist providers, but also engagement of non-physicians, such as diabetes educators, nutritionists, and clinical pharmacists, who can provide a great deal of this care independently, including not just education and counseling, but in many circumstances, medication adjustment and monitoring. We must also think about ways to integrate information technology into the care of patients with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. One possibility would be the delivery of certain aspects of education or feedback directly to the patient who is interested in engaging and learning in that fashion. But we should also be cognizant of the way that we can use IT to both audit and review periodically how we are delivering guideline-based care in our clinic population so that we can ensure that our care is consistently improving. And then, of course, we must always remember that structured patient education and empowerment is fundamental to improving the outcomes in this patient population. Thank you for watching. I hope you found these episodes useful for your clinical practice.
This has been an activity published by Peer Voice.